For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast. Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind. The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to this very special episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. This is a special episode because it is about Albert R. Broccoli, who it's no hyperbole to say that beyond Ian Fleming, he is the man most responsible for the success of James Bond as a film franchise, really. Obviously, Fleming invented him, and then Broccoli is the man that's carried the torch for Bond and continues to, in a way, through his family. So, Albert Romolo Broccoli, born in April 5th, 1909, died in June 27th, 1996. Known to all his friends and family as Cubby, and that's how we'll be referring to him in the podcast, I imagine, because it's easier than calling him Albert Romolo Broccoli every time. So he's an American film producer, made more than 40 pictures, films throughout his career. Obviously the co-founder of Dan Jack and Eon Productions, and obviously his biggest contribution to the film industry and to obviously this world that we cover in this podcast is that he's the producer of pretty much all of the James Bond films. So we'll run through his credits quickly and then we will get into his life. But it's worth mentioning here that a lot of the stories around Cubby we'll be covering in the individual film episodes as well. So, for example, when we're talking about casting Sean Connery, you'll find that in the Dr. No episode or even in the Sean Connery episode. It won't be here. We're talking just about the life of Cubby Broccoli. Right, so the credits on the Bond franchise, co-producer with Harry Saltzman. So they're Dr. No, From Russia With Love, Goldfinger, You Only Live Twice, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and The Man with the Golden Gun. Then he's listed as co-executive producer with Harry Saltzman on Thunderball. Then he's sole producer on The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, and Octopussy. Then he's co-producer with Michael G. Wilson on A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, and The License to Kill. And then his final credit on the Bond films was as presenter slash consultant on GoldenEye. And ever since then, the films have been released under the banner of Albert R. Broccoli's Eon Productions presents Ian Fleming's James Bond 007 in... So then his sort of credit lives on in that. So that's a bit of an introduction into Cubby Broccoli. But Brendan, why don't you tell us a bit about Cubby's early life?
So I'll take you back to 1909 and in Queens in New York City, where Cubby was born. He was the younger of two children and he's born to immigrants from the Calabria region of Italy, Giovanni Broccoli and Christina Vents. So he actually almost didn't survive from his actual birth. He was a breech birth and he was born and had trouble breathing. Luckily, his grandmother, Marietta, she'd resorted to a remedy that was traditional from the region where they were originally from, involved the insertion of a head of a black chicken into Cubby's mouth.
What?
Yeah, I know. But it worked. And so he started to breathe again. So It saved Cubby's life. And then growing up, as a youngster, he'd sell fruit and veg on a stall in New York. And then in the winter, he'd sell Christmas trees. And all that produce was grown on the broccoli farm. Not the broccoli farm. The broccoli's farm. Incidentally, on a side note of that, their name actually is believed to derive from his ancestors, so Cubby's ancestors, who crossed the cauliflower with pea seeds to create the vegetable broccoli.
I came across this quite a few times when I was reading, but it...
So what you're saying, is it apocryphal? Is it crap?
Well, it's a lot of people are disputing it, that there's no actual evidence.
I found a lot of people saying it was true. I mean, it definitely had to be invented. So
broccoli definitely comes from that region in Italy as well. So I think the two things could be connected.
Yeah. And it is a cross-pollination. So I'm awarding it to him.
I mean, he's done enough to not have to use that as a
that's true.
As a claim to fame.
So the name Cubby came from his cousin, who was a mobster, Pat De Chico.
Chicho.
Well, he gave him the nickname Cubby after a comic strip character who was called Cubbibble. And so that eventually got shortened down to Cubby, the Cubby that we know now. So when on the death of his father, the rest of his family moved to Florida, but he stayed put in Queens, in New York City, with his grandmother. And he worked many different jobs, including making coffins. But it was a trip to see his cousin when he went to LA that gave an ambition for film. His cousin was an actor's agent and introduced Cubby to certain people in the film industry that inspired him to go ahead, move forward and pursue that career within film. But I'm not going to touch on that.
So, yeah, it's going over to California was really the start of Cubby's career in film. He went over not permanently to stay with his cousin Pat, but just he was kind of coerced into going over there because he was telling him how good it was, and went over to visit and see what the place was like. And when he first went over there, interestingly, the first day they went over to Pat DeCicco's where he lived, and within a few minutes, a couple of hours, there was a knock at the door, and Cubby goes up to open the door. Cary Grant stood there, just saying, "Is Pat in?" He's like, "What's going on here?" And apparently, throughout the course of that day, just celebrities turned up the house just to see this his cousin, and obviously Cubby's there thinking, "What, this is amazing? What's going on?" That evening, apparently, and this is according to his autobiography, he went to a bar and he was with Pat, and he was just playing with some silver coins on the table that he had in his pocket. For some reason, he said he had three silver coins on him at the time. And he was playing with these coins, and a man who sat just a few seats away turned over to him and just said to him, "Heads or tails?" And eventually they just had a little bet on whether it was heads or tails. And he lost $3, the three coins that he had, to this man. So the man bought him a drink. And it was Howard Hughes sat opposite him.
Wow.
So that's a pretty interesting entry to your time in California. But he didn't get involved in films early on. He was there for quite a while, and then he eventually decided to stay, started working there. He landed a job with the Paris Beauty Parlor Supply Company, based in San Francisco, selling hair nets, shampoos, conditioners, and small hair dryers. And then he had a job with an exclusive Beverly Hills jeweler, John Gershgorn. So he did those for quite a while, but it wasn't until he met Joseph Shent, who's head of 20th Century Fox at the time, who finally got him a job as a gopher. And do you know what a gopher is?
Go for this, go for that.
Exactly, yeah. So the guy who just gets anything that the kind of big chiefs need, like coffees, suits, cars, anything like that. Yeah, yeah, basically, yeah, yeah. So yeah, he was doing that for a while. That was his first kind of got into the film industry at quite a low level. It was at this point that he met his first wife, Gloria Blondell, and that was the reason that he decided that he needs to focus on his career. He kind of had a lot of these jobs and he was enjoying living in California by the sounds of it. But at this point he thought, right, I'm going to put some effort in and try and make it in the business, because I've got a wife now. So his big break really was working on the film called The Outlaw, which is a Western directed by Howard Hughes and an uncredited co-director of Howard Hawks, which confused me initially. I actually always get those two confused. Howard Hughes, obviously of Spruce Goose fame, and then Howard Hawks, Bringing Up Baby, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Which one's The Aviator?
Howard Hughes. The Spruce Goose, he had an aviation company.
Right, but he also made films as well, right?
He also made films, yeah. But he, so on this Outlaw set, so he went, It's not associated with Hudson Hawk, but we'll talk about that in the Hudson Hawk podcast when we start it. But anyway, on the Outlaw, he'd met Howard Hawks before, and they had quite an easygoing relationship. So he felt like he could say to him, could he have a job? So Howard Hawks needed an assistant on the Outlaw, and he got the role. He got the job working on a pretty big film at the time. It had Jane Russell in it, and it was her breakthrough role. Obviously, became pretty famous after that. Interestingly, while he was on set working with the Outlaw, he was asked to look after Jane Russell and like keep an eye on her instead of hiring bodyguards. And that was apparently because Hughes was a bit of a ladies' man, and he had a lot of, if you search on Google, you can find he's got a big list of female people that he's associated with. And apparently at that time he didn't want bodyguards that he didn't know looking after Jane Russell because he had a thing for her. Apparently nothing happened, so he got Cubby to do it, which was quite a big job for a guy to do, and he asked Cubby to do it because he was married and he trusted him. So that was that's quite a nice way to get some kind of trust on your first job in the film industry. After Outlaw, things changed quite a bit. So Pearl Harbor happened in 1941, and suddenly the whole of the American film industry changed. And in many ways, and especially for Cubby, it was for the better, because America had a massive propaganda engine. They suddenly, all the filmmakers started making propaganda films, and they just all had work. And it was massive over there. Obviously, you know, military in America is enormous. And he just got work, Charisse, doing loads of stuff, working on morale boosters, warnings against careless talk, how to black out windows, dig shelters, all these different things. So he was just thrown into this massive world of filmmaking. He eventually became an ensign in the Navy. So and that's as far as he got in the Navy. And then he came out of there. And interestingly, had a bit of kind of moved away from what he was doing to an extent, because he became a talent agent for Charlie Feldman at a company called Famous Artists, and his role was covering RKO and the Motion Picture Center. So he suddenly just started working with lots of clients and dealing with that side of the business. That's really the last bit we can say about him until he started his next part of his career, which of course will be when he started making films. But there is a story that we need to cover about Cubby that happened over the course of this period. And it's an interesting one, but there's not a lot of information about it, and I'll explain why in a bit. But he was alleged to have been involved in an altercation with a comedian and Three Stooges creator, Ted Healy, outside the Trocadero nightclub before Ted Healy died in 1937. And there's loads of different sources on this, and there's loads of different accounts of what actually happened. But according to most of the sources, it was alleged that actor Wallace Beery, who was a massive MGM actor at the time, Broccoli, and film producer Pat DeChicco, who we know that is alleged to be a mobster anyway, beat him so badly that he fell into a coma and died in 1937. But the evidence around it is quite difficult to navigate, and obviously it's a long time ago. But one of the major reasons that there's no real evidence that exists on it is because of these two people who existed, Eddie Mannix and Howard Strickling, and these were known as fixers for MGM Studios. And what they used to do at the time was, if any actors or directors were doing something that was wrong and they didn't want to go into the newspaper, they would fix it. They would, you know, speak to the papers, speak to the other people involved, and stop the news getting out. And there's actually a book called Fixers, written by a man called E.J. Fleming. And when I was researching this, it just kept saying Fleming, so I was getting very confused about how this was all pulled together. Yeah, so Beery was immediately dispatched to a long vacation in Europe until the story died down. Stories around Broccoli were he admitted that he was indeed involved in a fist fight with Healy at the Trocadero, but he later modified his story, stating that a heavily intoxicated Healy had picked a fight with him, and the two had briefly scuffled and then shook hands and parted ways. In other reports, Broccoli admitted to pushing Healy, but not striking him. And there's a lot of disagreement over how the events actually happened due to the alcoholism of Healy. But because of all this lack of interest, there's not a lot of information it was kind of found about it, and there's not a lot of interest from the authorities about it as well. So it wasn't like the police were trying to find out who it was. There wasn't really much interest, and because of that, an autopsy didn't take place until after Ted Healy had been embalmed. So when they did actually do an autopsy, he was soaked in alcohol. So they said, we can't use this body to tell you anything. So after that, the Los Angeles County coroner reported that Healy died of acute toxic nephritis, secondary to acute and chronic alcoholism. And the investigation was closed, and there was no indication in the report that his death was caused by physical assault. So big news, but it's very strange. I mean, you know, that wouldn't happen these days, but there's not a lot of
I guess it shows how much of a small fry at that time Cubby was, because that, you know, the press wasn't going after it. Yeah. But interesting you said about the fixers. You've seen LA Confidential. They cover that sort of world, don't they, really well in that film.
Yeah. It's it's a really interesting story, and obviously nothing in Cubby's book that talks about that. That's something that's fallen into the history books, but or not into the history books.
Under the carpet.
But, there's not a lot of information on that. So there we go. That's the scandal.
So Cubby's success in the film industry really began when he joined forces with an Oscar-winning filmmaker called Irving Allen. Irving Allen had won an Academy Award in 1948 for a short movie that he produced called Climbing the Matterhorn. So he was a big deal in Hollywood at the time. Cubby formed a partnership with him in 1952, and they formed a production company called Warwick Films Productions, and they named it after the hotel in which they used to meet and discuss their projects. So they had grand plans to make films in America. They found that actually wasn't as easy as they hoped it would be, even though they had an Oscar winner on their side. But they were really hustling hard to make that money, and they just weren't able to come up with it. So what they did is they sort of looked around to see where you could get money to make films from. And they found that in Europe and in England specifically, there were a lot of incentives being offered by governments to film in those countries. So they relocated to England to make use of this thing called the Edey Levy. And it meant that basically it's quite complicated, but it's a tax break like you get now. But it means that successful films that were made in Britain with British stars, you would get more money from them at the box office. You'd get a higher stake in them. So what Cubby and Irving Allen did is they would recruit big American stars, but then work with British crews in international locations, often Commonwealth locations, because again, there was benefits for filming there as well. But what the Warwick films offered was real solid production values. These weren't films made cheap. These were films that made to look great. And often they sort of began to reflect Cubby's passion for travel and adventure. He was very much an adventurer. I read this story how he joined some sort of yacht race just for fun and gone traveling doing that. And they actually secured the actor Alan Ladd for their first film. Alan Ladd, interestingly, his son later on would go on to release the films as the head of a film studio, but that's later on. But anyway, so the first three Warwick films, 1953's The Red Beret, released in America as The Paratrooper, starred Alan Ladd, and you'll like this, was directed by Terence Young and written by Richard Maybaum. So this is where the Bond world starts to sort of formulate. Obviously, we don't know about it because Bond's not come on the scene yet. 1953's The Black Knight, that also had Alan Ladd, and also starred Peter Cushing and Patrick Troughton. So I'm quite interested to see that one. And then 1954's Hell Below Zero. All three of those films were international hits. And interestingly, under Warwick, Terence Young directed a film for Cubby at Warwick in 1958 called No Time to Die. So fun fact for you.
Maybe we'll just have to watch that one.
Yeah. So, like I said, they enjoyed some moderate success. They often filmed in Commonwealth locations under this thing called the Empire Development Scheme. And this is where the world of Bond, like I said, starts to percolate. So Ted Moore, who was future director of photography on Bond films, he was a regular cinematographer for them. They hired Ken Adam on a film, and obviously that's where he got his break into industry as well. Ken Adam worked with Sid Kane and also Morris Binder. So these are all people that who will come to in the podcast at later points. Bob Simmons did the stunts for the films. Peter Hunt edited the films. And then actors that often would appear in Warwick films include Bernard Lee, who would later go on to be M, Walter Gotell, Desmond Llewellyn, and many more. The links are all coming together now. So they made colour films. They shot on real locations. They had ambitious action, tight budgets, international actors, and they were often based on best-selling novels. So you could see the theme developing here. They Unfortunately, Irvin Allen and Cubby's relationship soured in 1960 after they'd made a film called The Trials of Oscar Wilde, and that flopped, and they put a lot of money into that, and it just didn't pan out for them, and actually led to them falling out with Columbia Pictures, who was releasing the films. And at that point, in fact, just before that, in 1958, Irvin Allen and Cubby had met with Ian Fleming to discuss taking the rights for Bond to make Bond films. And actually, I don't know how true this is or how apocryphal it is, but apparently Irvin Allen was quite rude about Bond to Ian Fleming in one of these meetings, said that the books weren't fit for TV. But Cubby was keen to do it. And Cubby actually even tried to buy the rights to Casino Royale as well from Gregory Ratoff's widow. He'll come into the story later on because he's the guy who bought the rights for Casino Royale. But the films that were sort of interesting him at this time to Cubby was he had a big interest in North by Northwest and Guns of Navarone, and they were the sort of films that he really wanted to move on to working in. So that's Warwick Films, and quite an interesting story there. And then I guess this is where it starts to become more recognisable for Bond fans.
So moving on from Warwick Films, after the Broccoli and Allen, that partnership, after it fell apart, this left Cubby looking for a new project and looking for a new production company. He met with Wolf Mankiewicz, who's a friend of his and a British playwright. And during that meeting, they revealed that he knew the other person that was interested in these Bond stories that Cubby was interested in. Cubby says, "I used to read the Bond books, but I figured that one of the major studios would have options on them. It was the writer Wolf Mankiewicz who told me that only Casino Royale was owned by a studio, but that a man named Harry Saltzman had an option of six of the others, but no deal to finance making the films." So there's the, you can see we're now starting to develop these connections. So there was a meeting arranged where they would meet each other and discuss, with Cubby wanting to buy the rights, buy those options from Harry Saltzman. Saltzman didn't agree to this and wanted to go 50-50, which they did. They agreed to, so this led to the creation of the production company E.ON, which stands for Everything or Nothing, which is very much, you'll notice throughout this and throughout the rest of the podcast, Cubby's mantra, very much Everything or Nothing. And then its holding company, Dan Jack, which was named after their two wives' first names, Dana and Jacqueline. So then, after having, they've got the options and the rights, they just need it to get it financed. So Cubby says, 28 years ago, Harry Saltzman and I walked into 729 7th Avenue in New York to United Artists for a meeting with Arthur Krim. I found 10 people in the meeting, including young David Picker, who had just been given the job of head of production. And Arthur said to him, "Cubby, tell me about James Bond." And so Cubby basically pitched it to him and sold it to him. He said he was the salesman. Picker, the young David Picker, said, "I'm very familiar with James Bond, but they were more interested in how it was going to be made and what their plans were." Cubby said he'd budgeted for the first one at $1.1 million, but United Artists agreed to $1 million. And then in 45 minutes, they'd struck the deal for the first six. So that's pretty impressive meeting to go into that and come out with a six-picture deal. He said, "When Arthur and I shook hands, I suddenly remembered that it was my second wedding anniversary. I thought, I'm here in New York with my wife and our one-year-old baby, and I've got a deal to make James Bond pictures. I'm flying high." So,
what a day.
Yeah, I mean, this was pretty soon after, which we'll cover later on in the episode, but he'd have quite a low point. And so this came at the right time for him. And so this is where it all starts now. Then they go on to make Dr. No, which is the first Bond film, which we will cover again as we cover Dr. No and E.ON and Harry Saltzman. We'll cover this, yeah, in great detail. So yeah, that's the early sort of
the genesis
seeds, yes, of the Bond story.
So Cubby and Saltzman had a deal with United Artists that they wouldn't just make Bond films. They also had a kind of contract where they'd also have to make another film every year that wasn't a Bond film. And Saltzman tended to, well, pretty much always was the guy going out making all these different films. But Cubby, his focus was largely Bond. That's where his interests lie. And he's not actually produced many films outside of Bond, but the two main ones during this period were Call Me Buona and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Call Me Buona, do either of you know much about Call Me Buona?
No.
I found it incredibly hard to... there's not even a trailer or anything. It sounds quite good. I'm a quite big fan of Bob Pope films, but I've never seen this film. According to Cubby's autobiography, When the Snow Melts, he talks about his time working on this, and he was asked by journalist and affiliate Donald Zeck, who's also the co-author of the biography, if they had any ideas for a non-Bond film. And Saltzman, who previously made a film called Iron Petticoat with Bob Hope, suggested that they do a Bob Hope movie. Zeck replied saying that he had a British rock and roll group called the Beatles, and they had sellout crowds, and they should make a film about that. Saltzman laughed him out of the room and said, why would he want to make a film about four young long-haired kids from Liverpool when he had Bob Hope? So United Artists made the Beatles film with Walter Shenson, A Hard Day's Night, way more successful than Call Me Buona, as you would imagine. The film was released in 1963. It sounds ridiculous, but if you've ever seen Bob Hope's early films, it's pretty standard for him. He plays a character called Matt Merriweather, who's a New York writer who is passing off his uncle's memoirs of explorations in Africa as his own. So in his house, he's like got all these African models, and he apparently has like African noises playing in the room when people come in, and it's all just a complete lie. But he's recruited by the United States government and NASA to locate a missing secret space probe before it can be located by hostile forces. Because he's an explorer in Africa, they want him to do this. So it's just your standard screwball film with Bob Hope. But it had quite a lot of... It had golfer Arnold Palmer in it. He makes a brief cameo playing a round of golf with Hope. Obviously, Hope's a massive golf fan. And I don't imagine we're going to be talking about I Call Me Buona much across the series, so I might as well go to town here. And it's interestingly a scene that's revisited in the film Spies Like Us, where Hope makes the same cameo appearance, which is interesting. The film was originally intended to be shot in location on Kenya, but there was the big problems of the Mau Mau uprising, and then so the producers would only let the second unit go there. It was a production that was it wasn't an easy production, and it was. Like, there was lots of problems with the writing, all this kind of stuff. Edie Adams, who was the main actress in it, thought she was going to Africa and had painful worries about it. She said that the film was almost written by as it went along. And initially her character was a nuclear scientist and then a big game hunter. But when she turned up on the set, she met a stuntwoman dressed like her character, throwing a male stuntman in a jiu-jitsu throw. And then she found out she was actually going to be a secret agent in it. So it's the film was just kind of pulled together as it went along, and because of that, in October 1962, after being in production for 2 weeks, Cubby hired a novelist called Paul Jericho to do a fast rewrite of it, and he basically worked. There were six writers that worked on the script before it finished, and apparently there were just hundreds and hundreds of jokes about bumbling explorer and CIA agents searching for this space capsule in Africa, but no story. So he had to pull all of these jokes together to turn it into a logical story. And Cubby paid him £2,500 for 4 weeks of credited work on that film, which is quite a lot of money, I imagine, at the time for a writer. And another interesting story is production director Sid Kane recalled that originally they planned to have loads of British animals released from British zoos into this golf course and film it all with all these animals running around a golf course, but they shelved the idea when it caused expensive damage. So that's quite interesting. So in Call Me Buona, there's actually a reference in From Russia With Love, which you might remember, where on the wall there's a picture of one of the main characters, Anita Ekberg, a poster on the wall, and the Russian tries to escape through it, so she escapes through the mouth and he shoots them, and he says she should have kept her mouth shut. And that's a reference to Call Me Buona, but it's actually in the Ian Fleming book, but it's Marilyn Monroe in the thing. So that's quite an interesting story. You can see they're rather having a bit of fun and pulling in different elements. So that was Call Me Buona. Interesting, different take on Cubby's skills from the Bond films. And then that leads on to an even stranger divergence from the Bond films, which I don't think I need to explain, but this is Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was released in 1968, which has enormous links to the Bond series. And this one, whereas Call Me Buono was Saltzman and Broccoli working together, this was just Cubby. This was his film. He was the producer on it. And according to, or Fleming used to tell stories about flying cars to his son, and he decided to, after he had a heart attack in 1961, he decided to write up the story as a novel. And interesting fact, he wrote the book in longhand as his wife had confiscated his typewriter to force him to rest after he'd had the heart attack, but he still did it. And the novel was published in 1964 after Ian Fleming's death. It became one of the biggest selling children's books of the year, and Cubby Broccoli obviously read the novel, and he wasn't actually that keen on doing it. He didn't think he wanted to produce it until he saw Mary Poppins and how successful it is, and said this could be the next Mary Poppins. I want to do this. It was the first in a multi-picture deal Dick Van Dyke signed with United Artists, and Sally Ann Howes played the female lead, and Ken Hughes directed from a Roald Dahl script. So interestingly, the songs were written by the Sherman Brothers, who also composed the music for Mary Poppins. Ken Adam designed the hero car, and six Chitty Chitty Bang Bang cars were actually created for the film. It was the 10th most popular film at the US box office in 1969. However, because of its high budget, it lost United Artists an estimated £8 million during the theatrical run. Wow. And that goes on further, and I'll try not to go too much, talk too much about Harry Saltzman in this, but five films produced by Harry Saltzman, including The Battle of Britain, meant that they lost United Artists £90 million that year. And contributed to United Artists scaling back its operations in the UK.
Wow.
Which you wouldn't think about with a film like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, but it was just so expensive to make. Interesting, I just thought I'd pick up a bit of critic information from it. Roger Ebert, he says, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang contains about the best two-hour children's movie you could hope for, with a marvellous magical auto and lots of adventure and nutty old grandpa and a mean baron and some funny dances and a couple of scary moments. And just finally, Peter Jackson owns one of the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang cars. So big film. And if you didn't know a lot about movies and you didn't know a lot about producers and directors, I don't think you'd ever even think that Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was produced by the same person as all of the Bond films.
Absolutely not. It actually feels quite Disney.
Yeah, and if you type in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, one of the Google questions that comes up is Chitty Chitty Bang Bang a Disney film? And I seem to remember having drunken arguments with people who thought it was. but yeah, and you know, it's just a big one, isn't it? And one of I imagine it's a favourite of many people around the world.
So they were Cubby's sort of side project, but while all they were going on, you had the James Bond films ticking on in the background. They did Dr. No, From Russia With Love, Goldfinger, and they all became, you know, incrementally bigger hits. At the end of Goldfinger, early prints of the film said that James Bond would return in Honor Her Majesty's Secret Service. But at the time, in the press, because of this growing success of the James Bond film, you had Kevin McClory, who had at this point sued Ian Fleming for the rights to Thunderball and the film scripts which the Thunderball books are based on. And so he was angling himself to make a Bond film himself. And the reason I bring this up in this podcast in Cubby, this is more of a footnote, but as I mentioned at the start of the episode, this is the one Bond film that it didn't act as isn't named as the producer on it. This is produced by Kevin McClory. Him and Harry are exec producers on this one. And what happened was is that Kevin McClory was angling to make the film. He had offered it to Richard Burton. But the week after the Goldfinger premiere, in a case of everything or nothing, Brendan, you'll like this, they decided to do a deal with Kevin McClory to prevent him from making the rival film himself. So they went all in with Kevin McClory because they wanted to make Thunderball. In fact, that was the first Bond film they wanted to make, but they couldn't do it because of the McClory situation. But McClory was desperate to make the film. They came to an agreement and they paid McClory $250,000 in cash plus 20% profits on the proviso that McClory could produce, but that he wouldn't try and make another film for another 10 years. And actually, it was a very amicable agreement. Mm. And Cubby is actually the godfather to Kevin McClory's children, which I thought was quite interesting.
Mm, very interesting, yeah.
And again, we'll cover a lot more of this on Thunderball and McClory episodes later on. But basically, Cubby said, we didn't want anyone else to make Thunderball. We had the feeling that if anyone else came in and made their own Bond film, it would be bad for our series. And so that's what they did. And actually, at this time, they were planning to make a film called The Pass Beyond Kashmir with Sean Connery, Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli. But in fact, to meet the United Artists' schedule, they had to drop plans to make that film and went ahead with Thunderball instead. And actually, there was, according to reports, quite a lot of tension on set between the regular crew and Kevin McClory and Broccoli and Saltzman. They were all very sort of used to doing it one way, and then Kevin McClory came in, and that caused quite a lot of tension on set of that film. But yeah, that's it. And I guess the flip side of the everything or nothing situation is they went all in with Kevin McClory, but when the people who held the rights to Casino Royale came along, they said nothing. They said, you go make it yourselves. And they knew that they were going to make an absolute fist of it, and they did. And again, we'll cover that on the Casino Royale episode. So they went everything with Thunderball, nothing with Casino Royale.
Mm. On to me. Just another little footnote in the Cubby story. So 1966, Cubby was in Japan with Harry Saltzman, Ken Adam, Lewis Gilbert and Freddie Young. Again, we're going to cover those in future podcasts. But the main story, what you need to know about this, is they had a ticket booked on a flight, a BOAC flight 911. And he actually cancelled. They cancelled their tickets so that they could go and see a ninja demonstration. Because of the film You Only Live Twice, it was being set in Japan, and they wanted the authenticity. They then cancelled that flight so they could see this demonstration. Sadly, that flight had been airborne for 25 minutes, crashed into the foothills of Mount Fuji in Japan. Oh. So, I mean, You Only Live Twice is quite an ironic, is that that was the title of the film, really, because that's like most of the team, the production team that survived that just by chance, just by the fact that they wanted to go and see this demonstration. Mm. So, yeah.
Amazing. So something that definitely isn't a footnote in the Bond history is the Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman split, which is a series of events that kind of went on for quite a long time. They parted ways in 1976 as business partners, but the actual process of getting to that point went on for quite a long time, and it was something that underpinned a large part of their relationship throughout making a lot of the Bond films. According to Cubby in his book, he says, this was no longer the normal disagreements between co-producers fighting it out over such things as casting, scripts or production costs, nor was it merely a clash of personalities, though that had happened for sure. The conflict between us went far deeper than that. And that's kind of, it's one of the, in all of the film, you know, people working on films, directors, everything, this is one of the big stories, isn't it, about a film company having problems with the team that went behind it, which seems strange, really, because of you associate those two so closely together that to understand that they have this really difficult relationship. Another quote from his book as well, which I thought was interesting, was, years have passed since then, during which Harry lost his dear wife Jackie and suffered a serious illness himself. But in reviewing my life and career, I can't ignore an episode which threatened to bring down everything I had worked for and put in jeopardy not only the fortunes of Dana and myself, but also of our whole family. It was one of the blackest periods I ever had to face, but for Dana's fantastic resource and devotion, I might have thrown in the towel. As it was, we took on the battle of a lifetime and won. So you can see how important this is, what such a big deal it was that lasted so long. And it really came down to, there's a lot of factors in it. And I won't go into too much depth about the Saltzman side of it here, but just really about what Cubby said about that relationship and what happened. But one of the things that he does talk about is that Saltzman had a kind of hot and cold relationship with Bond. He wasn't all in on Bond. He was a businessman. He wanted to make more movies. He wanted to use Bond for more than Cubby did, but Cubby was so focused on Bond itself that it was a very difficult relationship. He says, given a dozen pair of hands, Saltzman would be happiest having all the fingers in different pies. And you can kind of see that with all the films that you've worked on and all the deals. And that goes further, not just films, it goes into his business, or the way that he ran business and all the things he wanted to get involved with. He said, by contrast, James Bond, cruising along to become perhaps the greatest success in motion pictures, was a sufficient challenge as far as I was concerned. So even as far back as our second or third picture together, Harry had one eye over the other side of the mountain, saying that he was never fully on it. He was just always looking at the next big thing to do. Apparently he'd make appearances on the set or a location, do some shouting, and then he'd be off to France or Italy or somewhere else working on some other project, and or taking over a company, doing what he loves the most of all, playing the celebrated entrepreneur. There's lots of stories about on set problems that caused it, that happened on set that didn't just make issues for those two, it affected the rest of the crew as well. It caused loads of problems. And there's a famous thing where Saltzman had this elephant chase idea in The Man with the Golden Gun. I don't know if you know that.
Come across this, yeah.
Yeah, and Broccoli and people were saying, you can't have an elephant chase scene. They're too slow. It's going to be really boring for people to watch an elephant chase scene. And Saltzman said he went off and he spoke to some local villagers who said they could make shoes for the elephants to make them run faster. So he ordered 60 pairs of these shoes. They never filmed it. Cubby didn't let it happen because it was just so ridiculous. But he had these harebrained ideas. And then there was another one as well where he was talking about in Live and Let Die, there was a scene where Roger's in bed and he thinks he's in bed with Jane Seymour, but he turns over and there's a crocodile in bed. And there's this whole conversation about Cubby saying, well, why is the crocodile in the bed? Why won't he eat Roger? And all this kind of stuff. And it just went on for ages with Saltzman saying, no, he's just there. He's just got into the bed. So he had all these ideas, but apparently half of his ideas were great and half of them just were useless. So they caused all these rifts on set and they would argue about them and all this kind of stuff. So after all this stuff, he was investing in lots of new ideas. He was taking money out of the business, and this was causing lots of big problems for Harry and Cubby. And he says about it, he says, I don't think he ever consciously set out to bring me down. The plain fact is he was in a spot. He was in a corner with his back against the wall, and he wanted to get out of it by using me and Dana and our money to pay the banks. Well, there was no way I was ever going to let that happen. And then the legal battle around Dansack happened. Michael Wilson, interestingly, who studied law at university, he was one of the attorneys that was working with Cubby on that. And it all kind of started around The Spy Who Loved Me. And there all sorts of things happened. Swiss bankers claiming Harry had pledged 100% of the company to cover liabilities, said to be close to 20 million. Gary Hamilton, and this is an example of the problems that they were having causing problems for everyone else. So Guy Hamilton at the time said he was going to leave the picture. He just couldn't be bothered to deal with these arguments and these financial discussions going on. And it was that point that it really got worse because it was affecting directors and all these important people on the films. And Cubby says quite often that business people have these arguments. You have these problems with money, but as soon as it affects the other people that are making the films, you can't do it because the films won't get made. So they split in 1976, and then in 1978, the court decision, Saltzman and Broccoli had allegedly agreed to dissolve Dansack in 1972, but Broccoli later allegedly refused to honour the agreement. So these problems still going on. And then eventually, due to his financial difficulties, Saltzman sold his 50% stake in Dansack to United Artists in 1975. And subsequently, his health declined and he became depressed. And that was really the end of it. Bit of a sad end to the whole thing. But you can kind of see that. And if you read Cubby's book, he's quite sad about it. Those two were like, you know, they built the Bond empire originally. But to fall out over that was quite a big thing. So, yeah, that's the split. And then, obviously, they went two separate ways.
From what I understand from reading about it as well, they sort of, before the split, they would sort of take turns on who produced which film. Like, one would take a more active role, specifically around, like, you know, Man with the Golden Gun, I think, was more of a Harry film.
I know we talked about this before, didn't we? I didn't actually, I've not read anything on that in researching this, but yeah.
But I guess after the split, then you know, you're into, you know, peak Roger Moore era, Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy. And this is when we start to see Barbara Broccoli start coming in and Michael G. Wilson, his sort of adopted son from Dana, Dana's previous wife, and then Michael G. Wilson becomes co-producer on View to a Kill, Living Daylights, and so on. And then Barbara comes in on GoldenEye, and that's sort of his ongoing legacy from there. But I guess in terms of like the honours that were bestowed on him during his life, I'll just sort of whiz through that. In 1982, Cubby was honoured with the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award for his work in film at the Oscars. Now, the Irving Thalberg Award is very rarely actually presented at the Oscars. It's only ever been given out 39 times, and it's for producers who've made an outstanding contribution to the industry. So obviously this is a massive accolade for Cubby at the time. And actually, really interestingly, when Cubby was coming up through the film industry, you mentioned he was a jewellery salesman at one point.
Yeah.
At one point, he actually took samples to Irving Thalberg's office.
Yeah, I read that. I had that in my notes, but I thought I'll leave that bit out because that's a little bit too much information. But yeah, you're right.
But yeah, so he was given this award in 1982. Recent recipients of that include Kathy Kennedy, Frank Marshall, also, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's got it, Warren Beatty, Clint Eastwood, George Lucas. So it's a really prestigious award. So this was a huge moment for him. And actually, during those Oscars, they had a huge 007 number. Sheena Easton sang For Your Eyes Only. And then they had Dr. No and Blofeld. And actually, the actors who played Jaws and Oddjob came on stage and did this whole skit.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite funny to watch. Roger Moore then introduced Cubby. And actually, Cubby, he was just so effusive and, you know, grateful for everyone. He thanked Irvin Allen and Harry Saltzman for their contributions to his career. And Cubby called it the greatest honour of his life. And like the roll call for the party afterwards is ridiculous. It's like Cary Grant, Roger Moore, just all these amazing names.
It's probably one of those, you know, people say if you could take a time machine to any place at any time, that's going to be one of them.
As we discussed in the View to a Kill episode, he's got a stage at Pinewood named after him, the 007 stage that was named in his honour in 1985. Obviously, it subsequently has burnt down since in 2006, I believe, and rebuilt, but it's still the Cubby Broccoli stage. In 1990, he was awarded a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and there's pictures of him receiving that. Barbara Broccoli's there, Michael Wilson's there. So that must have been a great moment for him. And then it sort of posthumously, there is a cinema at the National Science and Media Museum in Bradford, and that is home to the Cubby Broccoli Cinema. It's got 106 seats. And in 2012, it was one of only three venues in the UK that screened the Olympic opening ceremony in super high vision. So that's sort of the accolades that he's received in his lifetime. But as I said, his legacy continues to this day.
Just to touch on his personal life, he was married three times. At the age of 31, he married Gloria Blondell, who was an actress. In 1951, he married Nedra Clark. Not at the same time. He did get divorced. He married Nedra Clark, who was the widow of singer Buddy Clark. Sadly, she died shortly after giving birth to their daughter, Tina. And then in 1959, he met Dana Wilson at a Hollywood party. He was then a widower with two children. And both had swore they'd seen each other before, and we were like, oh. And then he remembered that he'd sold her a Christmas tree.
Wow.
during his film, you know, career wasn't going so well. So she'd stopped to buy a tree from him in the street. And he said he felt like it was some sort of destiny. And he said, there are some customers you just cannot forget. So quite everything or nothing. So then Cubby spends the next 6 weeks, you know, wooing her, and it works, and they get married in Las Vegas that June, so pretty quickly, with Cary Grant as best man, as you do.
Not bad.
And so marrying Cubby changed Dana's life, like, massively. She up sticks and then goes and follows the Bond journey, as it were, and although not credited, she is a massive part of the Bond story, even all the way back to the casting of the first Bond, the casting of Sean Connery. It was her who had urged them to cast him, because there was a bit of doubt in their mind, And so she was basically the last one to have put her eyes over Sean Connery and knew instantly that he was the man.
Yeah, that crops up in a lot of research I've done with other characters where they've said that she was at the casting and you knew that you had to impress her as much as Cubby because she may well make the final decision.
Yeah.
Very, very important role.
Yeah, so it's like a sort of an unofficial advisor role, really, because it was never credited. So she sat in most production discussions. She read early screenplays. She was a writer herself, so that helped. She knew about structure. And Cubby said, "Dana is just as involved with the Bond pictures as I am. Her input has always been valuable, often crucial." Incredible to have someone who's got that, who's that influential, but is not, she's happy just to sit back and
be quite nice, I think, being able to be involved but not have all the additional worries that come with it, that probably come with being credited with the producer role and things like that.
That's true, because she still
knows
gets
that
to be involved,
she's so heavily involved with those films, but
she didn't want to cause resentment, was the main reason that, for not getting heavily involved. So no media attention, Bond premieres, she would just sort of stand by Cubby's side. And she was throughout the Bond, pre-Bond producing career, when it wasn't going so well for Cubby, Dana was really important, as I touched on earlier, about helping Cubby, especially after the financial catastrophe of The Trials of Oscar Wilde. It didn't get released in America due to its homosexual themes. And at the time, obviously, that was a big deal. So he went into a slump and was quite depressed. But she remained calm and kept that optimism and said that something was bound to turn up. And 2 years later,
Bond something came along.
Did turn up. Yeah, it did. Cubby said that Dana was the perfect foil for his personality. Strong, motivated woman who believed that their success was based on the strength of their family. So they had a daughter together, Barbara Broccoli, who we will come back and do an episode on herself. But Cubby also became a mentor to Dana's teenage son at the time, Michael G. Wilson, who again is another huge part of the Bond story.
Gotta give him a fun fact.
Yes, go on.
Michael G. Wilson's father was the original Batman.
Excellent.
That's just excellent. Well, there.
Amazing.
Yeah. So both of the children, they grew up on the Bond sets, and we'll talk about them when they get their own episodes, but there's some incredible early life stories. So now they are the co-producers now. So the family legacy lives on. Can be said about Bond that Bond is bigger than any one individual actor. James Bond is the real star. It's always one notch bigger than the actor who plays him. It's like a space station. It stays in orbit, whichever hero is up there at any given time. And it's because his ability to see that, it's made his career. He kept it in the family, and that's what's incredible. It's still now part of the Broccoli family. That legacy lives on.
And Michael G. Wilson's son is also now involved in the production as well. He's following very much similar path to Michael and Barbara as well. Yeah.
So it's really, really good to see. And I think it adds to something that keeps that special feeling with Bond, I think.
So yeah, Cubby died in 1996, age 87, at his Beverly Hills home. He'd actually undergone heart bypass surgery a year before his death, so the last year of his life was a bit of a struggle, and that was the year that they were filming GoldenEye. He's buried in Forest Lawn, Hollywood Hills Cemetery in Los Angeles, and the funeral itself was, as you would imagine, full of Bond cast members. There were, Desmond Llewellyn, Mariam Darbo, Timothy Dalton. I've read that Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, and Piers Brosnan there, but I couldn't find any kind of picture evidence of that. Interestingly, Tim Dalton was actually a pallbearer there, and there's an actual photo where you can see him doing that. So that's it, really. He's obviously, he created the most successful, longest running film series of all time. and succeeded in holding it to those kind of values that nobody else has ever managed to do. If that was a film company owning that and they were selling it off to different producers and writers every time, you wouldn't have that. And that's that mantle that's been taken up by Barbara and Michael G. Wilson, because it's not a business per se, is it? It's a family. It's just the fact that's what the family does. That's what they live for. Same way as if you see small businesses that families have, that they care about them.
It's passed down from generation to generation, isn't it?
Yeah, and you learn all those things and you pick up things along the way. And I mean, I imagine they've made decisions, as you said, Brendan, that they make decisions because it's a family and not because it's a business. And there may be points at in the story where they maybe did something that didn't make as much money as they would have done if they didn't make that decision. But it's to the test of time, hasn't it? And it's it succeeded just because of that. The New York Times said something interesting about him in his obituary. He was the father of the modern action hero, the progenitor of characters later played by Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone. So, and you can kind of see that, can't you? Like, if you compare James Bond now to Schwarzenegger and Stallone, it sounds ridiculous. But in those days, you didn't have Schwarzenegger and Stallone. They developed from James Bond, didn't they?
There's iconography of the action hero. Yeah, absolutely.
And I always think about this. This isn't a quote from anyone but me, but to kind of understand the Bond series is to kind of see the zeitgeist of all these different eras of film and stuff as they go along. So if you take it at any point, there's not a lot to Bond really. If you look at a Bond film, No Time to Die, if you watch that as a film, you'd go, good film, interesting, it's about a spy. It's the whole journey of it that's important, and that's Cubby, isn't it? Because that's his journey. He's created that, and he's held that story to his kind of how he wants to do it, how the family wants to do it. I tried to find comments on Cubby's death from the Bonds. I couldn't find all of them, but interesting one from Sean. Obviously, there was a lot of fallout with Sean at a certain point. There's lots of stories about that. But Sean said, my previous differences with Cubby Rocky were well known, but I recently took the opportunity to make my peace with him. I'm extremely sorry to hear of his loss. He will be missed. Which I thought was quite nice, after you read all those different stories that he says. Piers Brosnan, not a day went by during the making of GoldenEye that I didn't think of Cubby, and we wanted it to be the success it was for him. I'm deeply saddened that he's gone. Good stuff from the Bond guys. I really struggle to find anything from Moore, which is very strange, because I would imagine there would be hundreds of quotes from Roger about it. But yeah, I struggled. I even went through his books to find it. But
you would assume that that's a given, though. They were best friends. You know,
they were best friends. There's some amazing stories with Roger and Cubby. We'll talk about them probably more in detail in some of the other bits. Other things about him, really, he was into thoroughbred racing. We talked about horse racing in View to Kill, but yeah, he's got quite into that.
He had a horse called Brocco, didn't he?
Most successful horse was Brocco, who captured some major stakes races as the $1 million Breeders' Cup Juvenile in 1993 and 1994 Santa Anita Derby. He says, finally, I thought I'd end it on a quote, but I think your quote was actually better, Brendan. That we were lucky to stumble upon Ian Fleming and Bond was a bit of a good fortune. The rest was all hard work, which I think is pretty much true. Getting the Bond series is, if you were a rubbish producer or director and you got Bond, it could be rubbish.
Well, many, many, many action heroes came and went, right? But this one endured. And I think when you think about the history of it, you can sort of say Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, they're all basically, they happened on a roll, right? Yeah. It was obviously really important that they recast the character and that gave him the longevity. Yeah. But actually then when you look at the story between Harry leaving, you've got that era where, you know, they transitioned from the 80s into 90s, which actually culturally was very, very different. And Cubby, he navigated that. You know, he made the brave decision of bringing in Dalton. He could see the future that, you know, he was planning ahead. He brought Barbara in. He brought Michael G. Wilson in. He plotted Pierce Brosnan's arrival. He was really visionary in seeing that and seeing that into the next century. And carrying on as we speak.
I just think that there's no, I mean, there's producers that you know of, but none of them are history, are they? They're there's a lot of producers that you'd think, oh, he's a good producer, you worked on those films. But Cubby Broccoli is almost like legend. There's no producer as famous as him for creating anything, especially for that long period of time. And if you get time, read his autobiography, because his life was absolutely ridiculous. It was just one of those almost, I can't believe they've not made a film of him yet. There must be one along the way at some point. But but yeah, there's so much to him, and we could have gone on for hours on this podcast of all the stuff that we'd found out about him. But just so much to go through, and just a phenomenal man. And I suppose one of the most important things to say about him is that everybody who ever spoke about him talks about him just being really nice. And like, what's the stories about, you know, on the, I can't remember which film it was on. It was set in Egypt. Which one was in Egypt?
Spy Love Me.
And that they're running out of food, so could be making everyone spaghetti bolognese and all these kind of things that just,
yeah,
you wouldn't get that on a normal film set. It's
on a Bourne film.
Oh, they never do that on Bourne films. But it's true, isn't it? And you look at the and I suppose it's a testament to the fact that the company was theirs. Not, producers don't normally own the company. If you're a producer, you're a producer for hire. You've got to get the work done to get paid. But they had the luxury of saying, we're only doing the stuff we want to do. We're not doing this to get paid. We're doing this because it's ours. But obviously,
I've got a really interesting quote from Dana that sums him up quite nicely. Like I said, everyone always said what family atmosphere he created. But I think the other important thing to remember is he always had the audience in mind.
Yes.
And this quote from Dana is, when we were in a strange city anywhere in the world, and if there was a Bond film playing, Cubby would go and sit and listen to the reaction of the audience to find out what they like, what they didn't like. He had a great respect for the public. And I think that sums him up really, doesn't it? He's a great businessman, but also he's got a great eye for what people want to see.
Yeah. And you've got to care. And he does care about the audience. I watched a bit of a documentary where Barbara was talking about him, and she said that after the film was released, he'd go into the back of cinemas when the Bond film was on and just stand at the back watching what the response was. But because he enjoyed seeing people enjoy his film. He wasn't just, normal producer wouldn't go in there and watch that. They get paid. They're done. They're out there. And then, but he it was for him, learning from that made a difference, because it's going to affect all the stuff that went on afterwards. And he's not thinking, right, for the next film, I need to do this to make the money. He's thinking, I'm going to be doing this, or my family's going to be doing this for 200 years. I've got to think, got to keep building this, the same way you build a family business. You've got to make it last long and do it properly.
And he obviously saw that in Barbara and Michael, because and that rubbed off, you know.
Yeah.
Because we're still at that stage where you believe that they're doing it for the audience.
Yeah, yeah, completely. Yeah, you definitely don't. And I suppose there's films where it's something that if you're watching a Bond film, you feel that it's losing that. And you look at maybe Quantum. I think Quantum's probably, because of all the problems they had on it, it feels like it doesn't quite have that TLC that you expect from a Bond film, because it's a bit far removed, isn't it, from the kind of warmth that you get from the other ones. But if they started making Bond films that didn't have that, it wouldn't succeed. It would just, people would start watching it. It wouldn't be interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It'd be Fast and the Furious, which you'd probably quite like, Brendan. Brendan doesn't like Fast and the Furious, just to clarify. Although he does talk about it quite a bit.
on that note, should we wrap things up?
Yeah.
So I guess on next week's episode, we're going to go into Barbara Broccoli.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And the Cubby Broccoli legacy continues. Another fascinating story to delve into there as well. But thanks for listening to this episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Please give us a review, subscribe and like wherever you're listening to this podcast. If you want to contact us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, we're on James Bond A to Z. And if they want to email us, what's the email address?
Our email address is podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley. with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.